Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly.
And I'm Mike Philbrick.
This is Raise Your Average. The options income ETF category just crossed $1 trillion in assets. Covered calls on the S&P 500, covered calls on the NASDAQ, covered calls on single stocks, covered calls on Bitcoin. The idea is straightforward. Sell a little upside, collect a little premium, and call that income. But there's a problem with that trade that almost nobody is talking about. It shows up in the long-term numbers every time markets rip higher. You gave away the return. Income without growth isn't a solution. It's a trade-off, and it might be one you might not have to trade off anymore if the design is right. David Zichansky looked at the entire derivatives-based income landscape, saw what was missing, and built something structurally different. Not a covered call fund, not a single asset wrapper, something that tries to give you actual convexity, actual diversification, and actual income, all in one product, by pairing two full risk exposures and letting a sub-advisor run the options overlay with discipline. He's brought together two of the most respected names in systematic portfolio construction, Convexitas and return-stacked ETFs, to sit underneath his products. And the result is a category of ETF that barely existed 18 months ago. At Quantify, David is not only co-founder, CEO, and CIO, he is the architect of the stacked and income-stacked fund families, products that combine return stacking with option income overlays backed by Convexitas as the option sub-advisor and built in collaboration with return-stacked ETFs. Full disclosure, Mike is CEO at Resolve Asset Management, co-developers of return-stacked ETFs. David's flagship fund, BTGD, stacks Bitcoin and gold. His income funds, ISBG and ISSB, add a systematic premium overlay on top of that same stacked architecture. He has spent nearly two decades in the ETF industry and has had a hand in developing more than 75 exchange-traded funds over his career. He came up through Tidal Financial Group, one of the most prolific ETF platform builders in the business, before launching Quantify with a specific thesis that investors deserve leverage that doesn't decay, income that doesn't cap your upside, and access to institutional structures without institutional minimums. So this is a conversation about what the options income industry gets right, what it gets wrong, and what a better design looks like. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is Raise Your Average, dedicated to making you a better long-term investor. Join us as we sit down with some of the most interesting names in finance to discuss macro, markets, investment strategies, and more.
David, it is terrific to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Pierre. I'm a big fan of your show, and I'm excited to be here today.
Thank you. So, David, where are you coming to us from today?
I am based in New York. Our team is spread out across the country. We have people in New York, California, and Nevada. That's the beauty of the distributed world. And partnering with amazing firms such as you alluded to, ReturnStacks and Convexitas, and even my old firm, Tidal Financial Group, for a lot of the back office things and logistics that you may need a team in person. So I think the distributive workforce has been one of the thriving movements in the ETF space.
You've had quite a career. You've had quite a 30,000-foot view of the industry in the bulk of your career. It's not, like, you know, in the context of what we're talking about today, it's interesting to see, you know, to find out from you that you know, you saw this gap. And you saw a way, you found a way to structure a solution that largely solves this sort of perennial or sort of pet peeve problem that people have in the derivatives income space. But I think we should start in the space and talk about sort of, you know, the landscape problem. When you look at the derivatives-based income ETF space right now, everything from equity covered call funds to single asset Bitcoin premium products, what's the dominant design flaw that you keep seeing, and why does it matter so much at this particular moment in the market cycle?
Yeah, I think there's three main design flaws. One, oftentimes they are built to target an income distribution. And in doing so, they are not being opportunistic at all in their option strategy. They actually harvest more vol when it's lower and less vol when it's juicy, because they're just back-ending into an income target. Number two, they're very formulaic in nature, right? It's a lot easier to show a financial advisor or something that comes with an index that says, every month we do just this, nothing this, and in this simple framework, look at these amazing results. But as we all know, if there was true alpha in something like that, the hedge fund market would arbit out. And I think number three is the inability to compare and really understand how they're doing. And that's less of a product design, more of a market issue on the educational side. You know, as you alluded to, oftentimes the old age saying is, you know, you're going to get your income, but you're going to underperform on a total return basis. I think some people are willing to accept that, but I think some people have looked past this category because they think that's a structural issue with this category. And we're launching products to show that you don't need to choose between total return and income. And in the ability to compare, just understanding what is the beta, is there any potential for alpha that they're generating? And even further beyond just basic comparison metrics, I think people have to have an understanding of when should zero DTE do well, or when should a monthly option strategy do well. And people are oftentimes flying blind and just allocating based on performance over, you know, a 3, 6, or 12 month period. So building something that, you know, isn't formulaic, that has the ability to actually outperform on a total return basis, that is both opportunistically harvesting volatility when it's richest and making those tough decisions as to when should you be shorter dated or longer dated in your option strategy, that I find I ask a lot of allocators that question, look at me with a blank stare, and they don't have a perspective. And I'm like, if you don't have a perspective, find a manager that might have a perspective for you.
It certainly is a blind spot, isn't it?
It's kind of like a don't know you don't know situation, right? Unknown unknowns. Covered call ETFs had a really long runway. They started in 2000, I mean, in Canada anyways, they started in 2010 in earnest, you know, bringing those products to market. And it took a long time for investors and advisors alike to fully understand and learn how to use them. And it came at a time, I mean, you'd think in a period where, you know, interest rates were zero for so long that they would have caught fire sooner, you know, that they would have been hot products a lot sooner. And it's not that they weren't interesting or that investors, advisors were allocating to them. But the popularity of covered call ETFs has risen dramatically just in the last 5 years.
And I would equate that to two main things. One, the continued divergence in the K-shaped economy. And two is 2020 was the year that retail really decided to go heavy on DIY. And they went straight to the ETF issuers themselves. And that's one of the things that's been a stalwart of my career. Obviously, we fully intend to grow these assets in the RIA and institutional channels, but we're seeing equal success direct to individual retails, kind of positioning this as hedge fund tools for Main Street. Whether you want to call it Robinhood or just and free trading or just boredom during COVID, whatever your thesis is for why retail trading really started to pick up right around that time, we're seeing really the explosive nature of this category on the backs first of individual investors and also the financial advisor space. But it's amazing to see how quick the retail space, their knowledge curve adapts. This whole concept and world of financial creators, unlike financial advisors, they all communicate with each other. So they learn in a little bit of like a hive mindset. And if you hear the things they're talking about today versus just 2 years ago, you're like, did you go to college for options in the last 24 months and come back and have a totally different show?
Interesting. I kind of liken, you know, if I think about what you're doing or, you know, what you've designed here, it's, you know, it's kind of like comparing lane assist in a vehicle to full self-driving.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a very astute comparison. One of the things that the three of us were talking about is how your actual returns in a traditional cover call strategy are very much a random walk, not based on the prowess of any one manager. It's just based on the direction that the market goes. your exposure intra-month, intra-rebalance wildly oscillates. It might start at, you know, 74 delta or 74% exposure to the underlying, and 2 weeks later it might be at 50%. And that's not on the prowess of a manager. That's just a random walk of occurrences between rebalancing periods. And we just thought there was a better way. So as we've constructed this, we removed the random walk. We set a fixed exposure, two fixed exposures, right? A plus B minus cost of financing. And then we do the difficult thing of assessing what is the right option strategy for today's market, not just an index product, not just backing out into an equation of what is the desired income distribution rate.
Maybe we should dig into, you said a mouthful there.
delta exposures
changing, and we always have to remember in the ETF and fund construct that you're buying not just the day that the manager put the position on, but you might be buying 2 or 3 days after that, or 5 or 6 days after that. And so the exposure, that it changes, and many investors don't know the implications of that, why that is a meaningful variable. I'll give you an example. I was on Bloomberg talking about some of these ETF issuers that write calls, and one of them was called YieldMax. And it's in the name, right? You're maximizing the yield. And so that's the priority. But what does that mean, right? It means you're going to get this juicy yield that you can advertise. That it means that. But it also means the moneyness of the calls are quite in the money. And the caller was like, well, why do I seem to always have the downside? Or it seems like I'm capturing more of the downside. And it's because, well, you know, if you're going to sell right at the money and you're going to get all that call premium in, you've given away a lot of the upside. And then let's say 2 or 3 days later or 4 days later, it's even more in the money because of price change. That whole position has changed where you've got even more downside protection, or not more downside risk rather. And your income is fixed. So maybe you can walk us through some of the discussion points you've had there about a delta of 75 versus 50, why that's important, why that needs to change. And you can walk everybody through that.
Yeah, so I think Mike's example is perfect there. And really, if you want to understand like some of these ETFs that have these exceptionally high distributions, like what is not necessarily working here, you can just look at an up capture versus a down capture. And you can see, as Mike alluded to, you're going to get that downside capture and you're going to get capped and not receive that upside. So what I was alluding to with the example of, let's say, an S&P 500 covered call ETF, let's say you write monthly contracts and you write it on 50% of the notional. You're a couple percent outside of the money. On day one, I said you have a 0.74 delta. What does that mean? That means if the S&P moves up 1%, you're expected to move up 75% of 1%, right? And if 2 weeks goes by and the S&P has been floating up, let's say it's up 3% over the course of a two-week period, your delta now might be in the mid to low 50s. What does that mean? That means 2 weeks later, if there's another 1% move in the S&P, you might only capture 55% of that, 54% of that, significantly less. And as we alluded to in the beginning of the call, there might be some people who are seeking lower volatility in this, but I think there's a lot of people who buy these things, look back 3 years later, and don't understand, as you alluded to, Pierre, like, why am I underperforming the S&P? First, structurally, oftentimes I call the 1.0 version of these products is you have less beta, right? So you can't compare yourself directly to an equity benchmark. You should probably do a mix of T-bills plus the S&P 500. And even in that, many of these, because they're so formulaic, are showing negative alpha and not actually outperforming that. Uh-huh. But I think benchmarking them appropriately is step number one. And then what has the ETFs industry been in response to that problem is to just slap on a little bit of just leverage to that same process. And they'll do a 1.1 exposure, 1.2, 1.35% exposure to the underlying.
Right.
Sometimes these are called like 1.5x covered calls. You have that still same random walk. On day one, you might be 135% of the exposure. And then that's just going to randomly float over time. And there's no rhyme, reason, or logic as to what it's doing. It's just true randomness between their 12 monthly rebalancing periods a year.
you know, it's one of those situations where investors aren't asking the right questions, right? I think it took so long, you know, my point about the runway being so long is that it took so long to absorb the, you know, what was once a novel idea of covered call ETFs. And along the way, you know, everybody sort of just absorbed the trade-off as well, which is like, you know, if I'm going to get this yield of 8, 9, 10, 11, you know, 12% from this covered call ETF, whatever it is, and however it does it, I have to trade away the upside to get it because I'm selling call options against that upside. They just accepted it because that's how it works. It is that unknown unknown. I don't know what's not wrong with it. I don't know what's not right with it, right? I just know this is what I've been offered and I have a choice. I can do it this way, or I can do it, you know, the way you just described, David, which is I can buy the underlying and combine that with some ultra short bonds or T-bills or something and get the income that way and let the underlying grow on its own instead of trading away the upside for the income.
Yeah, I think a little bit pessimistically, I think oftentimes the product innovation in this space has been, well, how do we make this look a little bit better on a Yahoo Finance chart? And guess what? In a market that goes up more times than it goes down, if you're a 1.1 levered vehicle, even if you still have negative alpha, you will climb faster on a Yahoo Finance chart than someone else. But you still have that issue, as you alluded to, of if this strategy was capable of generating so much alpha, why aren't hedge funds doing this? And oftentimes with leverage or without leverage, whether it's a 85% exposure portfolio, 110, 135, there's still negative alpha being generated there. And that's where you need a true options team to come in and strive for some potential for alpha. As I alluded to in the opening, you know, if you don't understand when it might make sense to have shorter dated options versus longer dated options, and you don't understand all these Greeks and skew and IV versus RV, et cetera, like if you can't make those judgment calls, it's really hard for you to discern good from bad from one to the other. And that's where a true options expert like Convexitas comes in and makes those calls. And even in this short year since we've launched in January, we've been in probably about 4 different options regimes with like low vol, high vol and IV and RV, high vol and IV and low vol and RV. The collapse of vol, right? There's been so many evolutions in this market through these geopolitical risks that we've seen, that, you know, you have to be a true options expert to be able to maneuver that and be able to generate some alpha. And, you know, no discredit to our competitors out there. They've chosen to just say, that's a really tough problem. I'm just going to do an index approach and not think about that. But we do truly feel there's real alpha in trying to construct the proper option strategy at the right time. And then having the fixed portion of our strategy be the exposure. Hey, you know what you're going to get. You're going to get 1+1. It doesn't matter how far into the month we are. This thing gets rebalanced sometimes all day long. This trades, you know, 4 or 5 days a week. We're always repositioning to keep the simple top line message of this is a return stack like offering. You're going to get A+B, 1+1. We're going to strive for even a little bit of outperformance beyond that using this option side. But, you know, it's a lot easier to sell a product that you can show a fancy index in the back test, but it's not so easy for that backward looking product to actually create alpha in the future.
And I think some of it, well, we've seen a proliferation over the last few years of the yield being the main selling point. And we've talked a little bit about why that has its perils. And, you know, these are investor preferences to some degree as well. But there is a better way to do things, and Convexitas executes on a lot of that. So why don't you dig into how they think through the problem and how they're executing? As you said, you know, they're trading every day, multiple times a day, examining the portfolio, looking for those differences, looking for the surface of vol where there's an opportunity to get a better premium and provide that better index, and also looking at when vol is opportune and when it's not. And so maybe walk through the actual nuts and bolts of how they do what they do, and then connect it to how that results in the potential for alpha and a better experience for the end investor.
Yeah, it's a three-step framework. What is the vol environment we're in? What is the skew of that underlying asset versus its historical norm? And then where do the tenors potentially look attractive based on other things and also A and B? So one is volatility. And you can think of it as implied volatility, which is future volatility, versus realized volatility. Harvesting premium is harvesting expected increases, or where volatility is being priced higher in the future than we're actually realizing on a day-to-day basis. It's almost like selling insurance, right? You're selling that premium or a hedge against that. And if it doesn't actually come to fruition, guess what? The insurance provider makes a little bit of money. And that's where, you know, even at the when we're at the bottom of the markets in early April, like that's when, or it starts getting more attractive when you have high expected volatility, and all of a sudden daily volatility starts lowering. By like the second week in April, we were harvesting a lot of volatility because it was very, very juicy. Whereas a lot of firms would say, oh, we're going to back off because formulaically we can hit our index target or distribution target by only harvesting volatility on a quarter of the portfolio. They'll sell that to you as a feature because it gives them at least the chance to rebound off the bottom, right? Versus now, they will say, oh, we need to hit these income targets. Vol is low, but we're going to lean in and harvest a ton of volatility. So they're actually capping the upside a little bit more now. What we've designed is something that says you can both keep your exposure and harvest vol when it's juiciest as markets rebound. As you alluded to with funds that are capping significant portions of the upside, we've absolutely nailed the upside and the rebound, even though we were harvesting the most of volatility at that time. And that takes due diligence and constant repositioning in the portfolio by Convexitas to keep up with the delta, because your delta can change drastically if the underlying moves 5%. And we've seen a lot of these really big days. So number one is volatility. Number two is skew. And each asset class has its own skew profile. And you're kind of trying to determine, why isn't the skew profile of this asset class where it should be historically? Did it structurally change? Or is it set and due to rebound? And then choosing your tenors, like, is it worth it to pay for the hedge of volatility on longer dated options? Or is it not worth it and just sell shorter dated options where you don't get any volatility protection in those options? And these frameworks are done on a daily basis on each individual asset class. You know, we have 250 rebalancing periods a year, whereas a lot of these strategies are just like a very systematic weekly roll or monthly roll. We call them like risk. We call ourselves risk managers versus what a lot of the industry is doing is just like rolling on a scheduled basis, not based on any level of risk or opportunity in the marketplace.
I think the important distinction just to make very clear at this point in our conversation is that you're not asking investors to make that trade-off anymore.
Yeah.
What you're offering is the opportunity to harvest the income that they're already used to harvesting from their options-based strategy and maintain their exposure in terms of the underlying.
Yeah, you don't have to choose if there's one overarching mess.
So
you can do total return and income, and you no longer have to make a choice between the two.
And that's the trade-off that investors have been wrestling with, is the trade-off between income and total return. And that's a very traditional trade-off, by the way. That's something historically that's always been in the market. You've always had to make trade-offs between one or the other. But in this case, what's the real standout feature of what you're doing is that you're able to maintain both your exposure and the income and not have to trade off either. You can collect both the income and maintain your upside.
Yeah, I mean, we are outperforming on a total return basis, which would assume reinvestment, and we've actually outperformed by a couple percentage points there. So if you're using the entirety of your distribution, the price alone will not upkeep as does none of these, because you would have to add so much leverage to do that. But you aren't sacrificing that total return in exchange for income here, because, you know, at the end of the day, if you take a step back, like, I think a lot of people in traditional finance are kind of like alarmed at the interest in this category. And they say, listen, you can just grow your portfolio, and when it comes time for distribution, you can just make these distributions. I'm like, sure, you can do that. One, there's real value in intelligently harvesting risk premium. That's adding a real good risk-adjusted return to the whole portfolio. And number two, if you are asking people to decide what they should be selling to generate their income, that puts a lot of decisions in the investor's hands. And in that, guess what? Like, when you're going to take your quarterly distribution last year in the third, fourth quarter, you should be selling more Bitcoin than anything else, right? Because why? That's floated up more in your portfolio than other things. And today, if you're taking your distribution, you know, your monthly distribution at the end of this month, you're probably trimming your semiconductor and tech exposure. And so now you're asking individual investors to actively sell what's doing best in their portfolio to meet their distribution requirements. And we know, being in this industry, that's hard enough for professionals to do. To ask individuals to do that is just it's unlikely to be done in a good manner. It's much more likely they're going to want to sell their losers, use that cash. It's more tax efficient to do that, right? To sell your losers, not sell your winners. They have to not only sell their winners, potentially cause a taxable event by selling their winners. And you think about that and you're like, no wonder people want distributed yields for them so they don't have to make that decision. And so, as you alluded to, you don't have to choose between total return and income. And in this case, we go an added layer of stacking two assets, making it capital efficient in your portfolio, and then also forcing people to take advantage of diversification between asset classes, which is one of the only free lunches we have in this marketplace. And that doesn't just mean owning different asset classes. That means truly rebalancing between the random returns of those two asset classes, which, you know, as we alluded to, is asking people to make that decision of selling what's doing best in their portfolio and buying what's doing worst. And that's just very hard for people to do. So that's why we thought, like, packaging both, hey, you don't need to choose what to sell for your distributions. We are going to impose diversification on you, right? Those are two good features of what we're offering here in this income stack lineup.
I think the other thing is also that, so you've got two asset classes in the two different ETFs, but then you've got the volatility harvesting strategy on two different asset classes, which are going to have two different volatility skew and tenor profiles, so that as you're harvesting the income, it's just not this one thing you're harvesting the income, it's two. And the next thing would be, is it fair to say that, you know, if there's a trade-off, maybe it's this. Maybe it's the fact that if you target a certain income level, or you're trying to advertise a very high income level, we all know at the end of the day, it's total return. So if you received a 20% distribution, but your portfolio was up 10% for the year, I mean, you got 10% of your own capital back. Mm-hmm. You really didn't get any excess returns from that. And so if we target that income, it has this funny implication downstream of, well, you're going to have this sort of more capped upside, more robust downside, and you're going to have this underperformance on those asset classes. And that's a clear trade-off that you're giving up in order to have that income. If you're a little bit more flexible on the amount of income that you're going to receive over the period that you're receiving the income, that's the trade-off. You're not going to get this exuberantly high income or this targeted income. But for that trade-off, you're going to receive the actual returns from the underlying assets. You're going to get that delta one exposure of those two assets, whether it's stocks and Bitcoin or gold and Bitcoin, whatever those things are. You're going to get those returns. You're going to have a little bit of variability in the income that you receive. Is that sort of a fair way to characterize some of the trade-off?
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. And I would also say that what the fixed distribution target products are doing, those products aren't even giving you a consistent dollar distribution each period. They're giving you a consistent percentage, and that floats over time. So, like, not to get into the nuances, but one of the things we do to further provide a good experience as a shareholder for especially those who don't want to reinvest and who are actually using this income. Because at the end of the day, you know, a lot of people are depending on these distributions to pay for costs in their lives, is we actually lower the distribution rate when there's a pullback. When assets pull down, we'll lower the distribution rate. That just a little bit further protects the NAV of the fund and gives it a little bit of a higher base to bounce off of. And then once there's that rebound, we'll actually top off the distributions from a higher base. And that just, in our opinion, allows for the best shareholder experience in these vehicles. What we like to say is our income is not going to be consistent week to week, month to month, quarter to quarter, maybe not even on a 6 month by 6 month period, but over like rolling cycles, call it on a 3 year basis. Our goal is over 3 years, both your NAV and your distribution per share should both be trending upwards, and they should both be outpacing the cost of inflation. And I think a lot of, you know, the 1.0 of the retail excitement in this space were these maximum distribution funds, but they have no ability to grow their distributions over time unless their assets return surpasses their distribution rate. And, you know, show me a hedge fund that prints 60% a year. I'll give them all my money right now, right? It's just not feasible. We're right around right now a 19-20% distribution rate on a 200% exposure basket. The unlevered distribution is actually quite reasonable compared to pretty much anything we're seeing in this field versus our counterparts. And as Mike alluded to, we try to do this in as tax efficient way as possible. Obviously, when we successfully harvest premium from the options market, there will be some tax consequence to that. But a lot of what we focus on beyond that is what we like to call good return capital. You know, part of the 20% return on 200% stack is going to be the performance of the underlying asset. And that's what all these funds bank on. When you're distributing 12% on an S&P 500 fund, that's not all coming from volatility. Some of that is the actual appreciation. But that's the beauty of the ETF wrapper. We can do the in-kind creation redemption process, or also known as the heartbeat trade, on these ETFs, so that if Bitcoin jumps 20% and we're rolling our options, that's not a taxable event. And that's what we like to call good return of capital. You're getting that distribution. You're not just getting your own money back. You're getting appreciated money that used the benefits of the ETF wrapper to do so in a tax efficient way, whereas you couldn't do that in a separately managed account. And honestly, that's like one of the whole, that's kind of like the ethos of what we're trying to do here at Quantify Funds. And honestly, I think very much so with our partners here at Return Stacked, is we're taking what was once only available to the ivory towers and making it available to anyone in a more tax efficient, liquid, cost effective manner. What is the point of having an alternative if once it's returned an alternative path versus the rest of your beta, you can't act on it, right? And a lot of what's happening in the derivative income space in the ETF wrapper is the movement from the structured product world up to the ETF world. You needed to be a client of a big bank to get access to these structured products. They charged more fees. They were less tax efficient. And if you wanted to sell it, you'd actually have to pay a haircut to get out of it, right? None of that is true in this ETF world.
So there's two, we talked about the trade-off between total return and income in, particularly in the options-based income market. There's a second trade-off that's historically true, and that was that in order to diversify your portfolio, you had to sell one asset to fund the other, right? So if you wanted to diversify your 60-40 portfolio into alternatives, say you wanted to get into a long-short fund or trend-following CTA, you have to sell some of your fixed income sleeve to do that, or you got to sell some of your equity sleeve, or both, in order to add that diversifier. And then your portfolio becomes, 50, 30, 20, right? That's the traditional, adds up to 100% portfolio. And the return stacked part of the structure that you've created in your ETFs does away with that old saw, that old traditional trade-off, which is that you can invest in multiple assets without having to do away with or sacrifice any part of your portfolio. You can maintain your full exposure to your core portfolio and structurally add another asset on top of your portfolio without having to make that trade-off as well in order to diversify.
Yeah, I'll give full credit to Mike Rodrigo, Adam Corey at ReturnStacked for really bringing this concept into the ETF wrapper. Leverage that you can actually hold confidently over time, that you don't need to be a day trader to keep in line with your expectations. Every institution in the world uses a little bit of leverage. They oftentimes, that doesn't mean over concentration in one area. So this is a way that you can, like an institution, get a little bit of leverage and force that diversification. For us, for example, in the concept of Bitcoin and gold, historically, the combination of the two stacks has less than a one-to-one drawdown on Bitcoin alone. You get less downside in the stack.
Yeah.
Right? Then you're doing the upside. And I like to think of it as addition without subtraction. You know, let's say you're an investor that believes in equities and Bitcoin. And you're like, yeah, I like gold. Gold could be a good performer, but I think it'll actually underperform my benchmark. That's the addition without the subtraction. It no longer has to outperform your equity benchmark to be additive to your portfolio. It has to outperform the cost of financing stacked on top of a hopefully diversified asset like Bitcoin. And that really gives you the opportunity to find some potential structural alpha versus your equity benchmark without having to be a stock picker or a thematic rotation ETF manager. I'm not saying there isn't potential for alpha on that side, but why are you restricting yourself from just one way to strive for outperformance against your benchmark? There's so many different ways. And I think this just complements all traditional means of trying to find alpha by stacking it on top. There was a really good Wall Street Journal article, I think a week ago or within the last week, that said, is 90-10 the new 60-40? So 60-40 being stocks and bonds, 90-10 being, you know, essentially stocks and cash or bonds or whatever you want. And a number of people in this world commented on that, including Cliff Asness, who said it's not 90-10, it's 90-60. You just have 150% exposure to a 60-40 portfolio. You want some of that 40 to be in alternatives, great, this or that, whatever you want that to be. But it's not that bonds aren't good. It's just that you can actually increase your leverage ratio on a more diversified portfolio. And that doesn't mean you're necessarily increasing your risk, right? Like a 90-60 portfolio oftentimes is going to be less risky than 90-10 because it has some diversification embedded in it. And I think that this category of stacking assets is just in its infantile stages. I know there's a lot of big managers that have started to come to the market with products like this. And then there's also this other growing trend of derivative income space, right? And we are the only manager who like fit within those two categories of capital efficient stacks and derivative income.
Yeah. And let me try and crystallize that even more for the potential viewers. Let's say you have your portfolio of your 60-40 or 80-20 or whatever. So you have those US large cap stocks. And you say, you know, I'd like to harvest some vol premium on my US stocks. And I'd also have heard a lot about the vol premium that can be harvested on Bitcoin. And I'd actually like to have a position of Bitcoin. So instead of, you know, selling some of your stocks to go buy a covered right position in S&P and then selling some of your stocks and foregoing the returns in those stocks in order to have a Bitcoin ETF that writes that type of product, why not just take some of your S&P, sell it? You potentially replace that with the ISSB, which is the income stacked stocks and Bitcoin ETF. So let's say you've sold 5% of that and you buy 5% of the ISSB. What that does is it replaces the S&P that you had. So you get that back. You get a covered right strategy on that. And then you stack upon that Bitcoin trade with the volatility premium harvesting. And now you've got a few things going on. One is you haven't given up any of your stocks. You've not given up any of the delta of the upside of those stocks. So delta means upside participation. If it goes up a dollar, do we go up a dollar? Yes, we do. We've harvested the premium from that. And then on top of that, you stack the Bitcoin exposure with that harvesting of Bitcoin on top. And so that stack at 5%, very livable. It's going to add some income to your portfolio. You know, you could stack 5, 10, 15, 20%. When we look at stacking across a broad array of strategies, not just income stack, but thinking about managed futures, merger arb, gold and Bitcoin, those types of things, what we see is about a 30% stack actually is the same annualized volatility. But what happens is you improve diversification, you improve Sharpe ratio, you improve Sortino ratio, your returns go up, and your maximum drawdown actually goes down. And that's what Cliff Asness is getting at. That's what Dave's getting at. And that's, these products are built to be built within the portfolio that you have already. And so that's how you think through what the stack size might be inside of your portfolio. So it's not about buying this as an all or none stack size 100% each. I mean, you can do that, certainly. It's going to create a little bit of a different sequence of returns, which creates a tracking error issue, right? So if you're underperforming the S&P 500 and your buddies are all giving each other high fives because they're in the S&P 500, well, those behavioral issues are not to be trifled with as well, because they do cause bad decision making. So you have a stack which keeps your tracking error acceptable, but gives you these excess returns and keeps them in the portfolio even during the tough times, and rebalances between the two, right? So you've got rebalancing going on between two asset classes, vol harvesting going on between two asset classes, and a stack that you can put into your traditional portfolio. So it makes a lot of sense in my mind, obviously.
Yeah. That was great. David, when did this idea click for you? Like, when did you have this light bulb moment, this epiphany of coming up with this idea of stacking stacks and getting Convexitas to run the options? What was the vision that sort of created that?
Yeah, I'll say it's a two-step process. One was spring 2024 before we launched BTGD. And honestly, that was fully because of all the amazing work that Mike and team were doing at ReturnStack, and just realizing the amazing capabilities of what this can do for people's portfolios. Just a pure stack, capital efficient, tax efficient manner. These ETFs are only becoming more tax efficient over time. And then second was spring of 2025. You really saw retail go heavy into this derivative income space, and their way of fixing that solution of underperformance was targeting just an underlying with more volatility than the traditional benchmark, whether it be single stock or this or that. And I saw a way of, like, how do you give them upside growth? How do you give them the ability to actually compound wealth and also create a total return stream that actually has the potential to create alpha? And as I alluded to before, really what I think what these folks wanted is something that in 3 years and 5 years are going to have higher distributions than today. So how do you give them upside, and how do you give them something that will give them pay raises over full market cycles on their distributions? And that's where melding, you know, what we'll call the industry would call, like, two Delta One targets on the option strategy, two exposures of 100% in this stacked concept, managing the distributions in a thoughtful way, so you don't over distribute on pullbacks, et cetera, and allow a vehicle that people can actually participate on the upside and also get a distribution that will grow over time. You know, both BlackRock and Goldman Sachs are about to launch what I like to call 1.0 derivative income Bitcoin ETFs. They're going to be very traditional Bitcoin with cover calls. And if you think about, like, Goldman, for example, and the success of Gepi, you know, they're going to do it just in that 1.0 fashion. It's going to be a very basic index-like process that sells calls, has a less than one exposure to the S&P, but their clients are wealthy, and they're willing to accept a little bit less top-line total return. They actually probably look at the lower vol as, like, a feature. But let's face it, most of the people in this world need wealth to grow and to accumulate. They need to continue to compound. So creating a vehicle as to how can you allow people to compound their wealth and also make distributions that they will be thrilled with in 3 and 5 years. And in my eyes, that means the distributions have to be higher per share in 5 years than they are today. And that all reverse engineers into how you construct this. And, you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but Bitcoin volatility, at least as of the close of last week, this week it's a little bit higher. Bitcoin's volatility was like at a one-year low, like in the first percentile of the last 12 months last week. Do you think you should have been harvesting a lot of volatility in Bitcoin in that environment? Like, no. And that's where, like, really being able to be adaptive to this market adds that little bit of potential for alpha on top, which, you know, is the icing on the cake. Obviously, most of the returns are going to be dictated by the underlying asset class. But that really is just what I think fully classifies these offerings as true hedge fund-like offerings in an ETF wrapper.
Yeah, I mean, extremely creative. I just... Like, did you know, was this sort of the result of lots of conversations with different folks and sort of,
yeah,
you know, did you wake up one morning and you had this, like, the light went off and it's like, wait a second, you know, we can do this. The incumbent idea has created this bias. It's hard to let go.
Yeah.
Well, this is the way I understand. So I'm going to go with what I know.
Yeah, it's all right. I spent almost 12 years at Tidal, so
it's
over a decade in the trenches of what do people actually want that they don't know they want today, right? Like that.
Yeah,
that's the question every single day, right? And I saw the phenomenon in early spring last year of this massive dash to all things derivative income. They wouldn't even look. New product launches, just buy. And at that point, if you didn't have a 40% plus yield, they wouldn't look at you. They really wanted to focus on the 60% plus yield.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, like, you know, socioeconomic environment of the world, the K-shaped economy, whether you're soon to retire and, you know, you can't buy a real estate portfolio at institutional rates, so you can't make any money off of it. It's really hard to create passive income if you're not an institution. Like, these things kind of level the playing field. Even if you're, you know, a young investor and you have kids and you're paying for school and you need growth, but at this period of your life, you need some distributions. Like, I saw what these people were desiring. And then I looked at the inefficiencies of what they were grabbing based on what I thought they actually wanted. And what they wanted was the ability to compound, the ability to have growth in their underlying vehicle and to have a high level of distribution. And, you know, yes, there will be some variance in that distribution over time, but how do you try to instill that distribution will be higher in 3 years, in 5 years, in 7 years? So not only paying them, but paying them in a manner that, like, can compound over time and still give them upside on the underlying asset, right? And so that's where the culmination of all this came together, is that these people need distributions, but they also need participation on the upside. So a lot of the retail investor space would call it like the growth and income, derivative income category, but creating something that optimizes both how we're generating derivative income, doing that in the most optimal, efficient way with the true active mandate, and also something that can compound over time.
That's key, yeah. Right? So we've seen you know, the large income ETFs that in the covered call space, and the NAV erosion that eventually occurs. That's not a sustainable product. That's not sustainable for your retirement. That's just not a sustainable income source. And I think what David is alluding to is, like, listen, you need to maintain that capital in that asset class to go through the ebbs and flows and the variance of that asset class. And on top of that, you want to layer on some derivative income. That's great. And if you want, you know, one-to-one participation and you want some volatility harvesting, you should want those. Those are great things to have a desire for, but they will not be successful to your ultimate goals from a financial planning perspective if your NAV is eroding at 10% a year in order to give you 15% income. That's not long-term sustainable. And so the light bulb has gone on, and Dave's been a wonderful advocate in the space in putting this product together and finding a firm like Convexitas that can deliver on this, and then putting it in a return stack wrapper, which is fantastic. So, like, that, from the perspective of long-term success, right? That's what this is. That's what this product and the advisors in the product are going to provide. And that is a wonderful thing. And it's not a flash in the pan type thing in my mind. The other thing I'll end with on that, like, how are you finding conversations, David, as you go out and talk to advisors and finfluencers, and whether it's the DIY space or the RIA space, how do you convey all of these ideas and talking points in order for them to have the light bulb go on? And I'll just leave it there. How are you helping the implementation and adoption as we go through this learning curve?
Yeah, I think number one is helping them better understand what they have, which means understanding the sacrifice between alpha, total return, and income, right? And what they're actually giving up in that essence. And then it's asking them their process. How are you picking what type of strategy you're doing? What is the rationale behind it? And leading with education, honestly, I think a job that Return Stack did an unbelievable job, like reigniting this category in the both financial advisor and retail space in the 40 Act product wrapper, and leading with education as to some of the examples we walked through today as to when is a short-term option better than a long-term option, just in a holistic sense. And they're like, well, I don't know, but zero DTE did great for the back half of 2025. Like, look at those returns. And honestly, giving them the tools to assess products beyond just a Yahoo Finance chart, right? Or even just a total return chart. Like, how do you take a step further in assessing these products and leading with education? And, you know, as we talked about earlier, upside versus downside capture, why this concept of no long-term NAV erosion really depends on two main things. It depends on your ability to truly participate on the upside as much, if not greater than the downside, and setting a reasonable distribution target that you can expect over market cycles that you can actually generate from the returns within the fund and not just eroding the NAV through distributions endlessly over time. So really leading with education as to how do you actually truly assess this category and what are the active choices that you as an allocator still making. You're deciding what kind of option strategy you want, even once you choose the manager, this or that, and saying, do you feel equipped to make that decision? And if not, maybe a portion of your allocation should go to a manager whose alpha is coming from making those decisions.
I love it. And how have you thought about the fee structure in this from the perspective of, you know, in the absence of value, we got to talk about price. But there's a lot of value being delivered here. And this is value that if you're an individual investor, you're not going to be able to do. You're talking about a broad array of strikes, looking at the volatility surface and all of those things that we've talked about today, and then adapting to the market environment on a daily and interdaily basis. So this is not something that's going to be easily done by any individual investor. So, you know, I look at that and say, oh, okay, there's got to be some cost to that. How have you come to a pricing decision on this vis-a-vis the marketplace?
Yeah, so our expense ratio is 114 basis points. And I'll actually very boldly claim that I think that is exceptionally cheap versus our competitors. 114 basis points on a 200% exposure portfolio. The unlevered expense ratio is 57 basis points. 57 basis points for two Delta One strategies, or in this case, one Delta One. Oftentimes our competitors are charging 70 to 95 basis points. For a product that isn't even Delta One, that rebalances once a month, right? They're doing 12 rebalancing periods a year. If you want to get 100% exposure on the asset, you actually need like 120% exposure to that vehicle. So you multiply your 75 basis points by 120, and that's the actual expense ratio of a Delta One version of a traditional cover call strategy that in that is only rebalancing once a month based on essentially something that is calculated by an index. Whereas our unlevered expense ratio is 57 basis points with daily rebalancing. And I think that really puts into context that we're actually very cost effective from a fee perspective. But if you want to break it down further and look at fees per rebalancing days, then that's when it gets really juicy. But we don't have to do that. But you know, this is a truly active strategy that's been able to add percentage points of alpha in under a 4-month period. And so again, the unlevered expense ratio is actually quite cheap in my opinion.
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
And if anyone's wondering, if anyone's wondering, you know, what the day-to-day activity looks like, in the options management that's coming out of Convexitas. Just check into the Twitter feed, right? David, what's your Twitter feed?
It's cool. Yeah, so we are Quantify Funds. You can actually, we post our daily trade files for yesterday's trades on our website on quantifyfunds.com.
Yeah.
And the new addition that you're alluding to is Quantify Funds on Twitter. Every day we trade,
or X,
following, yeah. Or X, excuse me, sorry. Every day we trade, the following day, we will post a trade rationale, not only to what we traded yesterday, but the reason behind it. It has to be a little bit formulaic and in construction for compliance purposes, but you can really get the insights into a true options hedge fund manager's mind as to what they're seeing in the markets, why they're making these moves. And, you know, some days it's just blocking and tackling to get the exposure back up to 1+1. Some days it's making a judgment call on the volatility or the skew of an underlying asset. And as I alluded to, we've been in 4 vol regimes this year. Like the portfolio was one thing before the war, or one another at the start of the war, another in the belly of the war, and another when volatility collapsed last week. As I alluded to, Bitcoin's volatility was as low as ever. And guess what? Now it's back up. So there's probably more opportunities that Convexitas is seeing in volatility in Bitcoin today than they were last week. So you can follow along and see rationale on all those trades on a daily basis, which to my knowledge, I know there's other ETF firms that post their trades, but I think there's very few that are posting trades and trade rationale, especially in the complex world of derivative income. So I will we'll definitely, when we have some very big trades, we'll make some videos specifically on those X posts. But it's a great way for you to understand the mind of a true options hedge fund manager in rotating through the markets. Convexitas likes to think of it as like their daily risk budget for the most part, is like, where are you spending your risk budget to get back to that 100+100% exposure? And where do you see opportunities to get that exposure? You know, sometimes we're harvesting more volatility on the call, sometimes the puts, sometimes they're 6 months, sometimes they're 2 days till expiration.
And I think that's
extraordinary transparency.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing there for me is it gives the investor, it helps them build intuition, right? When we talk about education, this is one of the core pillars that David and Quantify Funds has taken on as well. We need to educate. Part of that education is an ongoing stream of, hey, this is what we're doing. This is how it's changed. So you can now go back and look at when did you start doing this?
This is day 5. I think we're on day 5 of post.
Right.
Yeah.
So you've got 5 days now where you can go back and look at the decision-making criteria, but also into the future, right? So think about a year from now, you can go back through and see the decision-making criteria evolve. That builds intuition and understanding for yourself and potentially for clients or for the individual DIY investors out there, so that you can understand a little bit more what's going on in the products that Quantify is managing with Convexitas. But also you can compare that to the rationale that was going on in the current covered call writing or put writing strategy that you have currently. And you can see the difference in the dynamism, in the adaptation of what the strategy and products are doing in response to the changing environments that are occurring. And I think that is a great way to sort of continue to educate yourself on building that intuition, building a little bit of understanding of what's going on, so that you don't panic at the moment where there's some inopportune performance, right? So that you can build that intuition to hold through those periods.
One of the interesting things about, I mean, I think the transparency definitely adds to the behavioral stickiness. I think when people can follow, you know, what you're doing, what's happening, you know, there's less of a feeling that, you know, this is a black, I mean, it's not a black box, but there's less of a feeling that it is, or it's too complicated even for you to explain. But if you can do it on a daily basis, that's it's an extraordinary level of transparency. The other thing is that, you know, they're getting the distributions too, right? Mm-hmm. And part of what makes these strategies sticky is the distributions. But when you couple that with, you know, all that is wrapped up in this strategy, you know, the two exposures for the same dollar, doing away with the trade-off between total return and income, you can see where that's a very attractive combination, especially for those who are already deeply familiar, for advisors and investors who are deeply familiar with the, you know, the covered call ETF space or the derivative options, the options-based income space already. What's it like when you have a conversation with advisors who are already, you know, deeply in that space? Do you see that sort of aha moment in the conversation?
I think first off, oftentimes there's, as you alluded to, there's a little bit of a shock as, wait, you can be this active in an options strategy in an ETF wrapper, like this actually exists. And secondly, as we alluded to, even for individual investors, it's helping them understand like how well their current products might be doing. And that's the beauty with AI right now. I can just be like, listen, take your product, take the cues and the cash, throw it into any AI model you want, ask it to create a benchmark for you. How are you doing versus that benchmark? And you really get to see that it's just kind of a little bit of a higher price version of beta, sometimes with some slippage and some negative alpha. And so telling that, you know, walking them through a chart of the exposures over time through a month, what a traditional cover call strategy does, and seeing our flat line of like a consistent 100% exposure over time, I think it even makes it difficult for them to understand like how do they allocate to these things. Like if you're not looking at this from a risk perspective, you're just saying, oh, I'm selling some stocks and I'm buying some S&P cover call that should be one for one. Like it's not. You're actually taking chips off the table. And so helping them understand what they have, leading with education, and then offering what we think is a better mousetrap and a better tool to actually get the what they intended to get the entire time with this category in a way that they should fully understand what they're receiving and expecting, and be able to see a week's return and be like, this makes a whole lot of sense. Versus like, oh, the manager did better than the S&P. I guess they hedged the market. Nope, it was a random walk. It was a total random walk in rebalancing periods. And making them understand that, you know, if it's available in an index format and if there were real alpha in that index format with a just regular once a month, once a week rebalancing, like any alpha that's available there is going to get eaten up by a hedge fund very, very quickly if there's real alpha there. And I think just understanding why we have this framework where we have enough leeway to be active to try to generate alpha, but also enough constraints that you should fully understand what you're receiving on a day-by-day, week-by-week basis. And I think once they dig deep enough, they actually start to see, oh, actually, I have a better job of predicting what I should receive from these funds than I do even the derivative income 1.0 space, right? Like, go look at a 30-day period in SPY over the last 30 days and ask an advisor allocates to any cover call ETF to try to predict what those returns are. It's damn near impossible. They have no idea. They're like, I don't know, maybe 70%, right? They won't have a rationale to construct that. And so they're driving blind a little bit. And I think that's the one thing advisors don't want to do. They want to fully understand the risks that they're taking. So you're not taking float risk on your exposures here, right? You're fixed exposure. Your risk is like deviating a little further into longer dated or shorter dated or into the call side or to the put side. And, you know, if you hear an interview with Convexitas and Zed and Devin once, you can very quickly come to a conclusion that these guys are true options pros. And I always like to say to the, whether it's an advisor or individual investor, it's like, listen, if you don't have a thesis on the volatility profile and the skew profile of these options, this or that, like you are literally driving blind. They're not, you know, Convexitas is not making a directional bet on any of these assets. And that's the beauty of it. It's active without making directional bets. Whereas a lot of,
This is, I think this is such a powerful point. Simplicity is a powerful lens, but complexity is often the reality, right? This is, if you're engaging in entering into the world of options and adding option strategies to your portfolios, you may like simple models. They're useful. They're understandable. But the complexity is real. And so every simplification hides something. The question is, what are you leaving out? And blind spots are the cost of simplicity, right? Complexity isn't the enemy. Unnecessary complexity is the enemy, right? So, you know, simplicity can create clarity, but clarity, you know, complexity creates accuracy, right? And if you're entering into this domain and you don't understand how complex it is and you're opting for simplicity, you have blind spots. And that's what we've talked about today. And the fact is, this is a complex regime area of trading. There's lots of complexity to options markets. And so if you're just thinking that, oh, I just want simple because it's understandable, what you're saying is, I want large blind spots. And that's probably not what you want. And it's what we were talking about earlier. What you know that just ain't so, that those are the blind spots you have to worry about. So while simplicity is good and it's understandable, it does leave some pretty bold blind spots that we've talked about today. And I think those are worth considering for anyone who's entering this sphere.
Yeah, that's interesting, Mike. I you know, from our conversation with Devin and Zed, I got the impression that Devin hears the word complex, but it's coming from a negative lens. Oh, this is complex. It's complex to understand. But for Zed and for folks like, you know, for professionals, options pros like Zed and Devin at Convexitas, it's Tuesday. To them, it's like, well, we do know about this stuff. Like, you may not understand it, but we do. The simple model that you've accepted is not, there's nothing terribly wrong with it. It's just not the best model there is of the best view or the most accurate view of what's actually going on, to your point, Mike. But complexity is not a negative. It's a negative from, you know, if you don't understand, you don't get it. Sure, you can view that as a negative. But maybe take the time to understand it.
Well, do you want to look through a keyhole while you're driving your car? Or you want to look through a windshield? You want to look through a keyhole? You want to look through a windshield? You want to have a rear view mirror and side mirrors? You want to have all the things around the car that inform you of what's going on around the car? You don't want to look through a keyhole to do that. And in simple strategies, certainly monthly rebalancing, you're looking through a keyhole. Mm-hmm. And you're only looking once a month. So, you know, a complexity, unnecessary complexity is the enemy. The fact is that this is a complex field. And the fact is that we've gone through 1.0, 2.0. I'd argue this is a 3.0 approach and product. And hey, if you're concerned with complexity, we always come back to crawl, walk, run. Start small. Build a position. Build your intuition. See how that goes. As you have a position that's small enough that you can defend it because you would rebalance to it if it went through the drawdown. And then when you actually have returns that go your way, now you've built a buffer. So maybe build a little bit more into the position. So there's always ways to adapt and adopt different strategies, different ways to approach things. And this is just one of those scenarios. Well, you know, yeah, okay. Oh, I accept there is some complexity. I do have some blind spots. Okay, so what should I do? I should probably start to educationally fill those in, but then I should probably start small, build a position, let it work in my favor, build that intuition with my clients if I'm a registered advisor, and build that position as I go so we can go through a crawl, walk, run scenario where people actually get to experience some of that and don't give up on a strategy when it's having a normal drawdown or something like that. And so, you know, have a full 360 view, make sure that you're, you know, crawl, walk, run. And I would say this is kind of a quantum leap in the way to approach the ideology of covered writing in a return stack format with two different assets, keeping that at full exposure to those two assets as well. This is you know, definitely version 3.0, and benefits, I think, the end investors in a significant way. And this is David's brainchild. I mean, this is something that Dave saw and drove him nuts to watch what was happening in the simple way that people were employing these strategies. And that's, you know, it got him motivated to create the product.
Yeah. I think building the solution to what people thought they wanted, and then made a realization that they weren't actually getting what they wanted from their current offerings. And, you know, back to Convexitas, they want to trade something that they think they can have some edge on, right? They're not just an index providing options job. And I want to be very explicit, their edge is not deciding the direction of any one of these asset classes, right? That is the fixed nature. And that's why, you know, the aha moment goes off with FAs and individuals, because they're like, oh, I know exactly what I should expect from this fund, right? Which is an amazing feeling, but still giving them enough leeway and flexibility to try to generate alpha in an area where they think they can find edge. And that's what I like to allude to as reading the options tea leaves of the volatility curve of each individual asset class and assessing the best way to harvest risk premium, how much to harvest, how much not to harvest in certain environments, and being that being the source of potential edge or alpha, and not saying Bitcoin's going to go up tomorrow, Bitcoin's going to go down, gold's going to go up, gold's going to go down. Like, allocators can make decisions as they see fit, and these are building blocks that fit within that construct that still give us enough leeway to generate some alpha around that construct.
Implicitly, we covered Bitcoin and gold as the underlying drivers of your strategies, and then the complement with stocks plus gold, stocks plus Bitcoin, in the ISBG and ISSB ETFs. But we didn't actually talk about the underlying base case.
Yeah. So
right. So what's the story? Like, what motivated you to first of all, BTGD, which is the 1+1x+1x exposure to Bitcoin and gold, yeah, that you're offering in that ETF, and then the income combinations that you have in the ISBG and ISSB. What's the premise? What's the underlying premise?
Yeah, the underlying premise is just the massive pace of currency debasement that the entire world is facing right now, and finding some form of very liquid assets that we expect will hold long-term store value. And then taking advantage of the market, not seeing them as the same thing. And that's where the diversification comes in between those two assets. And I think we're a really interesting moment for both gold and Bitcoin right now. I actually think, you know, if it wasn't for the war, gold would be at an all-time high and we'd be in absolute gold mania. The ironic part is the rationale for why gold fell is like the exact reason why I think people will turn back and see its long-term value as a store value. You know, a lot of the emerging market economies that have further adopted gold instead of dollars or treasury bonds were right to do so. One prime example is Turkey. Turkey has about a third of their balance sheet in gold. Unfortunately, if you're an emerging market economy that's an oil importer, you have a little bit of a hold to fill, and Turkey's been very, and other countries have been public about having to trim their gold a little bit to shore up their oil reserves and things of that sort, which is a perfect proof point for why this is what should be held on these balance sheets. But it's also what's caused a little bit of a short-term selling pressure. So I'm exceptionally bullish on both Bitcoin and gold. Talked about gold a little bit on the Bitcoin front. I mean, it's somewhat of a similar story. Bitcoin obviously is a little bit more exposed to the interest rate cycle of bonds. And if you look at where Bitcoin peaked versus where it is today, it very much coincides with increased rates in treasury markets around the world and the US and Japan. You also see, obviously, most of the earnings we've seen in this market in the last 6 months have been from innovation, productivity, increased earnings off of those innovations, and increased guidance off of those innovations. And I view the new construct of the portfolio as not just like stocks and bonds. It's really like beta and store value, right? And so it makes a lot of sense that when your beta is running from productivity growth, innovation growth, earnings growth, forward guidance expectations being set higher, that's going to cause an underperformance from the scarcity assets. But, you know, I don't think anyone believes we're in a world where the government is going to shore up our balance sheet and our deficits. We're at all-time high deficits when markets are at all-time highs. know, I always like to ask people, like, what is Bitcoin going to do if the S&P falls 20%? I was like, oh, maybe it might actually fall the same amount, if not a little bit less. And they're like, oh, so it's going to go down with it. It's like, yes, but then wait, what happens next? Because then the bazooka comes out and there's still much more quantitative easing to just dump into this market and this economy, and those dollars need to be absorbed somewhere. And at some point, it's like pushing a string on the equity markets. Mm-hmm. And then it just comes down to supply and demand. The other thesis, especially for Bitcoin in the last couple of weeks, has been simply people freeing up allocations in their portfolios for a lot of these big tech IPOs that are coming to market. I always ask, if you were an employee of SpaceX and you're now worth $200 million and you take a loan off your assets and you have $100 million of liquid assets to invest, like, how much are you going to be worried about the debasement of your portfolio versus the growth of your portfolio? Right. And my guess is you'll see a lot of people focus on the debasement side of their portfolio. I actually, I love that the fall was deemed like the currency debasement hedge trade. And that's what makes me so bullish on it, is because everyone looked at it as a trade. It's unfortunately for our society, it's unfortunate. It's not a trade. It's just a new state of being that we find ourselves in. And so I think people are going to come back to that at some point and realize, like, oh my gosh, that's not a trade. This is a stalwart of how markets are going to be for the foreseeable future. And that's where these scarcity assets come in. And that's where the combination of the uncorrelated nature of these scarcity assets combined together really add a lot of value. Yeah. I mean, I'll ask you, Pierre, like, if you just got your IPO check from SpaceX, like, how much are you concerned about growth versus preserving purchasing power?
Good question. I mean, in terms of deploying assets like that now, you'd be thinking more along the lines of being very careful.
Yeah.
I mean, and looking at that, you know, the market, you know, in a sort of parabolic upswing, you know, the US, Canada, most developed markets are, you know, at all time highs. It's a surprise, right? So it's unusual because there's so much, you know, feels like things are becoming more and more fragile. Right. But I can't help thinking, you know, looking at Bitcoin and gold, they've both gone through, you know, Bitcoin has gone through more of a longer, consolidation period, and correction, and gold, you know, surprised everybody when it didn't react as expected at the outset of the Iran conflict. So, you know, what are the conditions? And some folks have argued that gold is doing exactly what it was meant to do. It did provide the hedge. It did hit an all-time high, and investors took liquidity from it because it had performed so strongly, and it coincided with not only, you know, I think something you pointed out in our pre-chat yesterday, but it coincided also with the SaaSpocalypse and you know, the need that some investors may have had for liquidity in their portfolios and couldn't find, except in highly appreciated assets. And you know, I think, you know, you could point to gold as the asset people reached for when they needed liquidity. In February, March, when...
Yeah, I truly think it's as simple as the institutions and entities and central banks around the world that have most heavily adopted gold, ironically, are the ones that were most punished from this war.
Yeah.
Right? And it's really as simple as that. The emerging markets saw the writing on the wall for the dollar and the treasury bonds. They've been heavily skewing gold. They've been rewarded for that. And just like we talked about, you know, the retiree trying to figure out what should they sell in their portfolio to make their distribution, right? These central banks are faced with that same question if they have an oil shortfall for their economy. They're like, okay, I need to come up with cash. Well, maybe temporarily trim the asset class that's done the best in their portfolio, which is then gold. So I think, you know, timing is everything in this world, but if we do actually see a resolution to this conflict and we see oil normalize and people's fears of running out of oil for their economy dissipate, that's the moment when you're really going to see gold rebound very, very hard at that moment. And likely Bitcoin as well, right? Because that will probably stop yields from rising. If you recall, like Bitcoin's fall in 2022 very much coincided with rates and yields going up, right? It makes sense that a store of value with how income is going to be hurt when rates are rising, whether it's the short end of the curve or long end of the curve.
Right.
You know, that's a moment when you can anticipate that. And that's why there's no one asset class that should be the be all end all in your portfolio. You need some gold, you need some Bitcoin, you need some treasuries, you need some managed futures and alternative return streams in that whole mix. But if you, you know, if you just step back and look at it, it's like, oh, those that have the most bullish about gold are the ones who actually sold it. And they didn't sell it because their bullish stance changed at all whatsoever. The bullish stance is just as strong now as it was before the war. It just happened to be that those individuals or entities were the ones that felt the crunch of oil the most.
The other thing is that they don't have to sell. They just need to stop buying.
Yeah.
And that creates, you know, challenges to price. So you don't actually even need to sell.
One thing I was going to say was that, you know, they're both far more attractive today.
Yeah.
Like if you believed in Bitcoin and gold last year, why aren't you backing up the truck today?
Yeah, and everyone says that in hindsight, but, you know, trimming gold in October and trimming semis today, a very hard trade for people.
Both are all, you know, it's not easy, right? Both are hard to do. Like, nobody wants to sell their winners, really, like if they don't, you know, if they feel that they're going to continue to win. And that's the ongoing problem, right? That's the
description for why the derivative income category is of value to people, because they get the distributions without having to make those difficult choices. That obviously we're harvesting volatility risk premium and in a unique way, creating alpha from doing that. But at the end of the day, it's just really hard for people to be responsible for what should they actually be trimming in their portfolio.
David, wow. What a discussion. I have a feeling we're probably going to have to do a follow-up. This is extraordinary, and it's been great having you.
It's been a blast. Thank you so much for having me. Mike, thank you for this introduction and setting this up. So I'm honored to be here.
Been a pleasure.
Thank you, David.